Welcome back, or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and this is another episode of the Long Run Archives with frequent co-host Brett Hornick. We talk about Western States, the return of Zach Miller, and an upcoming duel on the Arizona Trail. Let's get started.
Brett, I gotta say, from our Western States preview episode, much to my surprise, the Wayne's World reference totally hit. I probably got more than a handful of DMs laughing about it, and I'm sure you probably got some too, right?
Yeah. Faith in humanity, somewhat restored, but yeah, I was confident about that one.
We kind of have a better sense of our demographics now too. Dude, Western States just happened. You were in it. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually feeling pretty solid. I mean, I don't think anything's really broken. Appetite's coming back. I mean, still kind of hurts to go up and down stairs, you know, all the normal stuff. But yeah, much better than when I did it last in 2018. Being able to fuel during the race is a big game changer. My stomach was great this time around, and that's helped out hugely with the recovery, as well as being able to think relatively well throughout the whole race.
Well, while you were getting prepared for Western States and racing it about a week ago, I got diagnosed with acid reflux disease. And the only reason why I bring that up is because one of the first things you have to do to troubleshoot is totally eliminate caffeine from your diet. So I'm on day 6 of no caffeine, and it's a borderline psychedelic experience. Like, I think I've taken for granted that the last 20 years of my life, the baseline consciousness has been fueled by caffeine. And now I'm just like my default self. And it's crazy, man. But I've had a ton of thoughts. So like, I was thinking, like, you know how like athletic brewing has clearly crossed the chasm and like won over our community in terms of like non-alcoholic beer tasting good and being like the go-to? Why not decaf coffee? Low acid decaf coffee? We'll call it inactive roasters.
I would love for there to be some good decaf coffee. If anyone knows some great decaf coffee out there, like, please send me a link, because I love drinking coffee, but I only drink like one cup a day, just in the morning. But I would love to have just some coffee to sip on all day. But I just have not loved the lack of flavors in decaf.
I think there's a market. I mean, I know that our community thrives on caffeine, but something tells me there's a large portion that likes the taste too. And yeah. Well, anyways, we got a ton on deck. I love these long run archive episodes. I think we'll mostly focus on Western States, but we got other topics in here too. Should we start off with the live coverage at States?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll probably be asking you more questions than not, because I didn't get to see any of the live coverage. You know, a lot of friends and family who I think ordinarily wouldn't have paid attention or followed the race at all were, you know, texting, you know, my parents and my crew the whole time, because they were watching it on YouTube. They were following along on Ultra Live and even getting up on Twitter. And, you know, between the three, they're like, a lot of people who never paid attention to a, you know, trail race ever were getting pretty invested in how the day was going. And I think that that barrier to entry to figuring out what's going on is getting much easier for fans.
I tweeted this out the day of the race, because you reminded me, we did an episode a couple months back commenting on the Cocodona 250 live feed, and we were shocked that we would tune in at like 10 o'clock at night and there'd still be 700-800 people watching the feed. This time around at States, there was like 11,000 people at certain times, especially as it got later in the race. Wow. And super cool. And I just tweeted out, this to me indicates people want to watch ultra running, and there's ways to follow our sport live in super entertaining ways. I thought that the commentary from Dylan and Corinne was awesome. It was super sophisticated. They didn't seem to run out of content. There was always a narrative they were following, and at each point in the race, they had something unique to say about like the section of the course, how the athletes were doing, how to prepare, how to react, stuff like that. So I thought that was incredible. I mean, hats off to them for their ability to talk for 17, 20, 24 hours straight. There were some complaints too.
Yeah, that is super impressive.
I mean, Twitter, if you hopped into the YouTube live feed, there was like a comment section. I'd say like every 10th comment was kind of a shot at the streaming quality of the video. But
yeah, it's like, do people not understand how remote Western States is? I mean, even 10 years ago, they were able to send out tweets, but yeah, no pictures. And now there is a video of the alien invasion that is the river crossing. Yes, the whole time.
Incredible. And I mean,
like, we are getting better. We are getting really good at covering races, and to be able to have picture out at Deadwood, right, Cemetery, it's really impressive. And I think, you know, people just take for granted a little bit too much how cell service is not worldwide.
Yeah, this was the first year we were able to get access, like you just said, to places we've never had access to on the course. Innovation doesn't come all at once. It's dripped out over time. You troubleshoot in real time. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the issues with the live feed, at least the way it was hashed out over Twitter, they were competing with like millions of cell phones out there at the same time, trying to ironically watch the live feed while being there physically at the race, sending out texts.
Yeah. Or using satellite internet that they've never used before. Like, this was the first time that they did it. So for, you know, feeds to only be down for what, like a minute or two at a time at the very most, that's pretty good. And for it to be so constant too, like, that takes so much power, and just focus and, you know, volunteer, just so many hours to get that going. And like, they were testing, they were using a new timing system as well. So I know at times there was some hangups on Ultra Live with the updates. That's because they moved their timing over to like the wands that you see at UTMB where they scan your bib coming in. They were using that for the first time this year over there. So that's like not going to be without a few hiccups as well. So, you know, there was a lot of new things this year on the tech side of the race. And, you know, this is year one, you know, it's only going to get more dialed.
It was super uplifting to me that despite all those technical difficulties, there were still that many people glued to the feed. Like, there were still that many people who thought, this is incredibly worthwhile, this is incredibly entertaining. I tried to get super meta during the process. I tried to pay attention to how I was paying attention to the feed. And I enjoyed it as like this ambient feature in my sort of scene that I had set up. So like, if I was doing some work on the computer, over on like a screen to the left, there was the feed. Or like, there was a point in the day where I had to go over to a party and I switched over to YouTube on my phone and connected it into the stereo on the car and was like just listening to Dylan and Kareem without even any video, en route for like 30 minutes. It was incredible. Like, there's just so many ways to consume it too. And all forms were entertaining to me.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, you know, kind of like we said in the preview, I was like, a race like this deserves this kind of coverage. You know, there should be this much going on. There should be this much availability to watch the race from, you know, whether you're just listening or watching an actual stream. The race deserves all that.
I'll add a couple things I wish we could get for future years. They did experiment with this a little bit in the second half of the race. They had, I think his name is Schuler Hall, who's done a lot of content with Air Viper Running and Run Steep Get High in the past. He was kind of acting as this sideline reporter, providing some updates from the field to Dylan and Corinne. I wish in future years that they can have that at every single aid station. So there's somebody like at Robinson Flat, at Dusty Corners, at Last Chance, who is like listening attentively to the crews and the aid station captains and the runners, picking up on any interesting conversations or tidbits and like relaying that back to Dylan and Corinne so that they can comment on that and, you know, prognosticate future, you know, into the race. I would love to see that. I'd also love to see more stories about runners for them to jump to. Like, they did a pretty good job of this, but like, let's say when Arlen Glick, for example, gets into third place late in the race, they can cut to some story that has like footage of him training or having success at other races or like being interviewed. It'd be kind of cool for that as a way to provide more context around like who's rising up late in the race. So just wanted to add those two things too.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think that's going to be all part of the evolution of this race. Like we're getting the pictures now. Well, we already had the pictures. Now they're moving pictures. Pretty soon they're going to be more live moving pictures. I feel like we're talking in like the 1950s right now, but for a race that's in the middle of the mountains and like most people don't even have, phone service aside from like Forest Hill. Yeah, it's pretty awesome that we even get to talk about this.
I can't let this go because I think it was all the rage on Twitter. In addition to some critique about the quality of the camera, the live feed, there was a lot of criticism about the lack of coverage of the middle and the back of the pack in the field. Like basically a lot of folks were saying you were ignoring those stories altogether and then only addressing them, during the golden hour or, after the two, men's and women's top tens had finished up. And that was very interesting to me because I'm trying to rack my brain. I cannot think of a single sport outside of ultra running where fans think that it's the responsibility of a single creator or a single media outlet to make sure that every story is covered. It'd be like if, people required ESPN to not just cover the NBA, but some YMCA men's rec league, like that to me is the comparison.
Yeah. Well, even in the NBA, they just don't let all the people who aren't the best be right in that league. Western States lets people who are not the best at the sport also run the race. So like, I can't even think of a scenario. It's like, if you had like a PGA tournament, but then they just had like everyone else also teeing off too, and they're like going to do profiles. And I'm like, it's hard enough for them to get storylines on all of the people who are going to be competitive. And I totally understand that every single person in the race does have an incredible story on how they got into the race, what qualifier they had, their training. Everyone has those sorts of things, and they're all super fascinating stories. I hope that in the future there's, more of a place for, maybe people who are in the race to submit their own content, like we had talked about in previous episodes. So at least Dylan and Corinne and whoever's talking to be like, we were shuffling through this one. Look at this bib number, yada, yada. That's a fascinating one. Maybe we should bring that up. I don't think it's Dylan and Corinne's responsibility to reach out to all 385 people in the race this year to ask them about it. I mean, I'm sure they would love to have those conversations, but they're stretched thin enough. It needs to be crowdsourced a little bit more.
Like you just said, I don't think anybody, ourselves included, nobody's saying that there aren't equally compelling stories and events happening in other parts of the race. But I think the problem is when you try to be everything to everybody, when you try to satisfy all parties involved, I think the quality gets severely diluted. And I think that applies to like virtually anything in life. One interesting thing I heard is that there was a person on Twitter who essentially made the claim that the people in the middle and the back of the pack have more interesting stories than the people that are competing for the podium. It's just an opinion, but also, how does your position in the race determine how interesting your backstory is? But I think there's like a frustration that, we're only focusing on, like the X's and O's, but even then, and sorry, I'm kind of rambling here. I think there's a mistake assuming that that's just surface level commentary. There are people like you, for example, that have deep knowledge on how to train, how to win races, how to compete. It's endlessly fascinating. It's substantive. It's not surface level. I think baseball is another great example of this with like sabermetrics and what the NBA does. So I don't know. I have strong feelings here.
Yeah. And I don't know. I feel like that's for the current live stream and Iron Far and for Dylan and Corinne, it's their job to commentate and paint the picture of the front of the race and the race, the competitive aspect of Western States. Maybe in the future there's multiple streams going on and other parts of the entire Western States brand that maybe there's multiple channels, multiple screens, multiple audio feeds that you can cut into and listen to other stories. But I think for now, I understand why the focus is towards the front of the race, because at the current moment, that's where the majority of people are, you know, that's kind of where the majority of people are paying attention to in regards to who's going to win, who's going to be in the top 10. You know, everyone wants, these are pro athletes. It's fun to root for them.
I think for me, it's just anybody that has decided to go mostly or basically all in on the sport, whether you're a race director or a shoe store owner, or you work in retail, or you're a coach, or you're an athlete, it has less to do for me with being elite than just people who are like fully invested in the sport. I should also say, even though I don't think this is relevant to my arguments, these are not people that I, even though I enjoy the elite part of the sport the most, these are not people that I identify with. Like, I am most certainly not elite. I'm at best an upper middle of the packer. So I'm a part of the group of people that supposedly need more coverage and attention in the race.
Ah, Finn, you're sub elite. You're up there ish. Just like myself.
Yeah, we'll do 22 hours, 21 hours at Western States.
Hey, I'll take 21 hours, you know, after having a couple of days to reflect back on it. I'm stoked with that. I mean, I think most people finish and wish it could have been faster. But you know, that's, you get what you get on that day. And I think it really comes down to how you manage those challenges and the decisions that you decide to make on course. And the kind of further removed I get from the race, the more proud I am of how I did, you know, react to those challenges and, you know, manage them, and, you know, the way my crew helped me out and just like keeping me engaged. I'm like, okay, you know what? You're right. It was good.
Well, let's switch topics here just a little bit. You were right in the thick of it all day. You were out there in the field. You were running the race. I think we can talk about your race in a little bit, but I'm curious, what were some things you noticed, like some trends this year in the race that were interesting, strategies that were being deployed? I know you're a great observer of the sport, so what were you seeing?
Yeah, I know. I was almost, you know, there's times where I think I was hanging out at aid stations or crew spots too much, just asking my crew, like, oh, how was Cole doing? What was Leah doing? How did Hayden look? How did Adam look? And they're like, Brett, we can do that later, you know. But you know, having crewed and paced twice at Western States now, and now having run it twice, I think, and this is also, you know, I got a lot, you know, from my crew as well. One of the biggest, I guess, I don't know, it's just kind of like continuing trend in this race, is if you are, you know, competitively racing this thing, and, you know, your goal is either to win or be in the top 10, you are just having to be more dialed than ever before. And most of that, what I'm seeing, is it's not so much the running parts, but it's all the other bits outside of the running. So the biggest, the number one was crews. They are, the top crews were so dialed. My crew took some videos of like Hayden and Adam coming through, and they were in and out so fast. The amount of stoppage time on this course is shrinking a lot. You know, even like when I ran it in 2018 and I crewed for David Laney in 2015 and then 2019, if you had around an hour of stoppage time during the race, that was really, really good. Now, I don't think there was anyone in either top 10 that had over an hour of stoppage time throughout the entire race. So, I mean, I wrote down, I looked, and this is all to be taken with a slight grain of salt, as it's all Strava's stoppage time, is it just adds up all the time that the GPS was going under a certain speed, but it's pretty good. Adam Peterman, who won the race, 25 minutes wow. of stoppage time throughout the entire. There's 28 stations. You know, we're averaging one and change minutes across all of them. And it's definitely not linear because he's probably spending 15, 20 seconds filling bottles at some of the, you know, middle aid stations. But even coming through his crew, hardly anything. You know, Ruth Croft had 35 minutes of stoppage time. And when you think about it, when you're running the times that they're running, if you have 30 minutes of stoppage time versus 60 minutes, and you run the same time, the person with more stoppage time is running on course almost 15 seconds a mile faster than the other person. 15 seconds a mile when you're trying to win this race, that's huge. You know, like, that's massive. So to be able to cut out 30 minutes of time out on course that's not running, you know, that's hugely beneficial. And that's only going to get, you know, bigger. You know, and for reference, last year, Jim Walmsley had 42 minutes of stoppage time out on course. You know, Adam had 25. And I do know that Jim started to take it a little bit easier, through some of the aid stations later on, but, you know, still to be knocking that much time off. And, you know, Adam wasn't the only one. Like Arlen Glick had 38 minutes of stoppage time. Tyler Green had 45. Tyler finished 1 minute behind Arlen. You know, had Arlen taken his time through some of the aid stations, Tyler might have caught him earlier and the podium might look different. You know, it's just like the little things like that are adding up so much more. Like the race for, you know, 10th and 11th on the men's side, like Jeff Colt and Scott Traer were together for a good part of the last 20, 30
miles. It makes me think, what are some things that gear companies can do to make the aid station experience even more assembly line like, or like pit crew like? Like, I think just to like the Salomon vest that I wear, it can be very difficult to reinsert the bottles back into those chest pouches so they're not like flopping out like halfway. That's a time suck right there to like really securely fasten it in there. So I'll be very curious to see, given how pivotal you're saying this was at this year's Western States in particular, whether any brands take note, like the Ultimate Directions of the world, the Naked Sports Innovation brands of the world, where do they go with this?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, at the crew spots, it's just getting all new things. Like when you come into your crew, you're not refilling anything. You know, if you have a pack, you're leaving it with them. They have a new one ready for you. If it's handhelds, you drop your old ones, they give you new ones. Like there's, in the past, yeah, this is another big difference. The, you know, the runner comes into their crew saying, I need this and I need this and I need this, and it's fast. And then the crew's like, oh, I'm ready, I can get all those things. Now, there is no talking. Like Hayden ran in to Robinson Flat and just lifted his arms in the air, and his crew took off his shirt. Well, they took off his pack, took off his shirt, tied an ice bandana on, put a new shirt on him, slipped handhelds on his hands, and then he left. Didn't have to say anything. They knew exactly what he wanted, because the planning has to be so dialed in of like, if I'm having the correct day, I will have these things, and you guys should already all know that. I can just stand there, you do it, and then I will leave. And that's how it was across the top men and women. It was incredible.
I'm not sure if this will ever pan out, but I will be curious to see how much longer, especially at the top end of the sport, family and friends act as crew and pacers for these elite athletes versus like professional people that the brands can point to and say, this person has crewed at every single race across the world. They know exactly what to do. They've studied the course. They're like sports science type people. They're just like professional mercenaries that like are experts at Forest Hill.
I think there is definitely something still to though, to knowing your runner and just like how they look coming in, you know, being able, because if you don't know that person, you're going to have a hard time kind of, you know, kind of mimicking the energy that they're bringing to the table. Because some runners don't want, you know, all the hooping and hollering and getting super hyped. You know, maybe they want that chill, just quick in and out. And you know, it's important for the crews to be able to know that. And like, yeah, the crews are just so dialed. You know, I'm seeing more, I saw more cooling techniques than I ever have. I think people are really paying attention to not just the ice bandana, but like having an extra water bottle just to soak yourself. You know, people have special hats, you know, keeping that core temp from just never rising. Like the top people, I don't think just, they didn't overheat. It wasn't even get the core temp down. It was just don't let the core temp ever go up. And that's huge. Yeah, I know we were kind of talking like, what's more important, getting in really good training and then being really good at cooling off during the race, or spending some of that training time getting good at heat training? You know, what school of thought's more important?
Okay, I definitely want to go to that later in the show. But you know what's interesting to me?
Yeah.
There were a lot of non-Nike athletes wearing that Nike ice vest. So how much more common is that going
to
be?
Yeah, I know. I need to... Yeah, you'd think someone else would build one. I mean, I've never held one in person. I'll have to ask some people about it, but it kind of looks like a weight vest, except it's just filled with ice packs. But it can't be that heavy because people are running with it.
And super, oof, one second, I got to sneeze.
Oh, gesundheit. Thank you. Make a wish.
It's weird to me that there are all sorts of awesome cooling innovations that we've seen in the past. Most notably, the hats that Courtney DeWalter and Ryan Sands wore at, I think it was like the 2017 and 2018 Western States, that you never saw go mainstream, or at least they were never made commercially available to runners like us. Like, where did those go?
I mean, I think, well, one of the big things is when you start getting into the science of cooling, it's more, well, there's actually cooling your core temp, doing things to do that. There's making your brain think you're cool. And some of those, I think, ice hats and even ice directly on the back of the neck, that they're learning that there's maybe some negatives in regards to tricking the brain that it's cooler than it is, more so than actually doing the things to cool your core off, because the blood doesn't flow through the body perfectly evenly. And there's a great podcast that Rod Farvard actually sent me that we should link one in the show notes. It's super fascinating about what a couple researchers at Stanford figured out in regards to how the blood flows through the body in regards to heating and cooling. They were trying to figure out originally how to bring patients who are coming out of surgery, when they come out of their anesthesia, you're essentially hypothermic. And they're like, how do we bring them out of hypothermia quicker? And what they learned, they figured out how to do that better. They also figured out the opposite as a result of when you get too hot, how can you cool the core off significantly faster than previous ways. So they've got some crazy inventions in the mix. Nothing that you can take with you on course, but I'm curious to see, like, in the next decade, if people will be wearing any of these cooling machines and just eliminating the variable of heat at Western States altogether. We might be in the golden age of Western States right now.
Wait, how come?
Because if you eliminate the environmental factors of the race, it just becomes a foot race. And that's definitely exciting too, but it's just one less thing to go wrong for everyone. And it's just one more really expensive thing for everyone to have at the front of the pack. And I don't know, to me that makes it a little bit less exciting. I mean, slight tangent here, but I was just talking with my wife Maddie about this, like, just this morning. We were like, what if at Western States, here's our what if for the day. What if at Western States, just like at Run Rabbit, when you declare that you want to go for the prize money, you're not allowed to have a pacer? What if at Western States, when you declare that you're trying to win the race or get into the top 10, you're not allowed to have ice?
Well, I was just going to say, the year is 2023, and Western States is only hot if you want it to be. Like, we've totally controlled for it with all the gear we have at this point.
I never once thought, damn, wow, it's hot out here. And I, yeah, all I had a third bottle with me full of ice and water to continuously spray and just drizzle across my shoulders, my hands, like my palms, my arm, as well as ice in my pack. I did the classic cycling, secret where you fill pantyhose with ice, make a little like Chipotle burrito size ice baby, and then you just throw it in your pack. It keeps the ice together, so it melts a little bit slower and it doesn't just bounce out and flatten everywhere. So it actually lasts much longer. So like once I had ice in my pack at Robinson Flat, there was never a point on the course until Green Gate when I stopped cooling that it never melted out all the way. So like I had ice on me the entire time and it never fully melted.
Wow. Wow.
So like that's where it's at.
That sounds like it could have come from the Hal Kerner Field Guide to Ultra Running.
No, he always jokes about it. He's like, yeah, you could have all the ice you want, but you could be bone dry in 10 minutes. I'm like, dude, not anymore. Not anymore.
You know what else stood out to me just as a fan watching the live stream? Hoka by far had the coolest looking kits, like the shirts that they had, like the sort of blue pink rainbow look, like at the very least, say what you want, it stood out from the rest of the field.
Yeah, like this the sunset is cool. Although I will say New Balance, their kits are that same color gradient, just more of like a pink to purple instead of orange to blue. All their track athletes have been wearing them this year, so like I'm like, that's sick, but that looks a lot like New Balance's track kits. And Vincent Viet, who got seventh, he was wearing that New Balance kit, so you probably see pictures of that. I think they both look great. Yeah, and it was cool to see. I guess was like somewhat of like a new kit debuted right around Western States time.
Very cool. How about those Nike shoes? How did they work for you? And did you get any sense of how they worked for the rest of the field that was using them?
So I think they're pretty great. I do think at times I was going too slow to get the benefits from them. So I guess what I mean by that is they are still very, very bouncy. And that only becomes a problem when you're kind of hobbling. So I definitely had that classic ultra shuffle going for the last 20 miles. And there was times where I just wasn't applying enough downward force to get the proper amount of spring back that I know the shoes can provide. So when I was on even just slightly technical terrain, my foot was spending so much time on the ground that it was at times just bouncing all over the trail. So I think it's definitely going to be a pretty specific use case type shoe. And, you know, as with what we're seeing in this sport, everything's just getting more specific. So I think everyone's going to figure out what their strengths, you know, weaknesses, et cetera, are. And there's going to be a shoe now to complement that. And, you know, I really liked that shoe, but I think for where I might have been in the last 20 miles of the course, I think I might have actually needed something a little bit more tame.
Well, on the topic of shoes, this thread has honestly been kind of going viral on Twitter this morning and afternoon. I tweeted out that of the shoe brands that made it into the top 10 on the female and men's side at this year's Western States, there was no Ultra shoe, no On running shoe, no Brook shoe. Speedland had a shoe in the top 10. Scott Traer was wearing a Speedland. There were two Scott runners. What do you think of that? Like 2 years ago, Ultra was sponsoring this event. And I know that like Keeley was a contender for the win. She had to drop out because of an ankle issue. And, you know, Kyle Curtin was a returning top 10 guy, but like Ultra just like mostly out of it. And like On running this up and coming Euro brand, like not there. Brooks, like, what do you think? What do you make of all that?
Yeah. So I had, the top 10s and their shoe models written down for everything, but it like is on a Google Doc that's on another laptop that should have updated, but didn't. And now it won't turn on. So I'm just going to pull up the top 10 men and women because I'm pretty sure I'll be able to remember. Yeah, you know, so it's interesting. I would think, so like, I would have expected, I guess, more from Ultra because, like, they rented a big house over in Palisades. You know, they had a presence. They did group runs and stuff before the run. When I was shaken out the morning before the race, there was like 30 Ultra people just storming down the bike path. And I was like, oh, they're rolling deep. So I guess when, you know, when a brand is that invested into the race, I'm sure their expectations are set pretty high, but you know, a lot of that's already almost determined a little bit before the race even starts. You know, if you only have one person or two people from your brand in the race, you know, of course you want them to do well, but it's easier to have success when you have like eight people in the race. It's like, well, even if half of them drop out, we still have four. You know, if you have two and half drop out, you now have one. And now that's a lot of pressure on one person. But I mean, yeah, I mean, Hoka being the title sponsor clearly has put a lot of, you know, they put some emphasis on trying to get a lot of athletes into the race. And, you know, there was definitely a lot of Hoka going on there. But, yeah, what do we got for, like, on the men's side, Hoka, Arlen Glick's unsponsored. You know, maybe we'll touch upon that later, but he was wearing Hoka. Tyler is Nike, Drew Nike, Ludo Hoka, Vincent New Balance, Alex Nichols Scott, Cody Lynn Scott, and then I didn't see pictures, but you said Scott Traer was rocking some Speedlands at the end. Okay, because I think I saw a picture of him wearing Speed Goats at the start, but then he must have switched into some Speedlands towards the end. And then on the ladies' side, which that was the other thing I noticed, very different, like. The like sponsored athletes in the top 10 and what they were wearing on the men's and women's side, very different. So I don't quite know what to make of that other than people might be good at running and lots of different things. Like Ruth Croft was Adidas, Elsa McDonald, I believe it was Katie Saucony. Yeah. Yeah, Marianne Hogan was Saucony. Lizia Bueller was
Saucony, yes. Oh, Marianne and Leah were Solomon.
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. Yeah, my still confusing a lot of thoughts this week. Yeah, Marianne was in Solomon. Lizia is in Innovate. Emily Hoggett was in Adidas. Leah is in Solomon.
Yep.
Taylor Nowlin was in Adidas. So there's three Adidas in the top 10. I don't know if they've ever had anyone
Ruth
win
Croft.
Before.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Other than this year. But Camille, Hoka, Katie, Saucony, Camille Bruyas Solomon, I believe.
I guess I wonder, like, and the reason I bring up the question of, like, these brands being absent from the top 10, does that just mean that these brands are developing a strategy attracting athletes that might not be interested in high performance around Western states, and maybe they're more interested in, like, the UTMBs of the world? Because when I look at like the roster for Brooks, there's people like Joe McConaughey and Garrett Heath and Hillary Allen, and you know, the list goes on there on running great people. You know, same goes for Ultra, but I'm just curious about that, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess that's that a lot of that comes down maybe to the brand and the stance that they want to take on, like, are we going to sign people so they can get us top 10s at Western states? Or are we going to sign people that we like, mesh well with the brand, but they can race whatever they want to race, and whatever that is, we support them? I don't know. And I'm sure some brands, you know, lean one way for the other. You know, like, it sounds like, you know, Solomon's definitely had a few up here, but, you know, I know that they put a lot of emphasis on shorter, like the whole Golden Trail series, like they sponsor a lot of like almost sub ultra runners, and Hoka doesn't do much of that at all. They sponsor mostly, you know, 100-mile specialists, it seems. And then you have companies like Nike, Brooks, Ultra, where, you know, Saucony even, where they're kind of all over the map. You know, some of those brands don't quite have the numbers in terms of their total athletes sponsored as like Salomon or Hoka. But yeah, I would love to learn more, like what, for some of these, you know, like managers of these pro teams, like what is their goal for the team as a whole?
Well, I think this is random, but I'm going to make a random prediction here. I think Arlen Glick, who is one of the two unsponsored runners in the top 10 this year, I think he's going to get picked up by Hoka, and I'll put money on that.
He just seems, I agree. He seems like the perfect fit for Hoka. He already runs in them. He's won most of his last races in them. He's good at hundreds. To me, that checks all the Hoka boxes. And he's also an extremely nice guy. Yeah. Got to talk to him a bunch after the race, and like he's just like pleasant to be around. I'm just like very grateful of the opportunity and everything. And then that doesn't mean he doesn't have a fire burning in him, because the other thing he was like, dude, I made so many mistakes. I left so much time out on the course. Like, I cannot wait to do that again.
Really?
Because I have so many things to fix. This was the next morning.
That's awesome. Yeah, he's super awesome. I got a chance to talk with him before the race. Super awesome dude too. Yeah. Agree.
Yeah. No, he couldn't wait to do it again. Because you're just like, dude, I already have so many things I would fix. I can go so much faster.
How about Scott Traer? Who do you think he gets signed by?
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, he's got the kind of like almost like cool lone wolfy type vibes, where like I feel like one of the like smaller companies that, you know, can, you know, that like Naked. I see him running with Naked. He was rocking their vest. Throw him some of their new shoes. Let him be the guy. Or that, like, or, you know, like Speedland's another great example too, of kind of a smaller up and coming brand. Like, I don't really know Scott at all, so I'm just going off of like pictures and how I've seen his training and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I feel like he should be the cool guy at one of these smaller brands.
A couple other stats I want to throw at you. I tallied up the percentage of international runners that were in the top 10 across the male and female races. 45%. 45% of the top 10 was international. So I know we talked in the previous episode. My picks were terrible. I mean, I think I got 580th place.
Yeah, dude. I beat you by 50 spots,
man. One
thing
we kind of got right was it was going to be a super international top 10 across the board. And it was. We just got the wrong people. But almost half of the top 10 international, which is kind of cool. And you picked Ludo. You said Ludo was the guy to watch. And very interesting race he ran and gutted it out for sixth. Yeah. But you said to watch out for Ludo.
I believe
Angel's
in Ludo.
Wonder.
Yeah. He is incredible. He had such a good run. Because everyone was thinking like, oh, he went out way too hard. And then he started falling back and everyone was like, well, that's the end. And then he just held. He just didn't fall back anymore, which actually reminds me of one of the other things. Like, what did you notice out there? Getting to talk to a couple people at the end of the race, one of the things that they said was like, aside from a few people like really blowing up, you know, there wasn't a lot of fading. Like I was talking to Jeff Colt after the race and he was like, dude, yeah, like I think him and Scott Traer were, you know, together, really close to each other, 20 miles to go. And Jeff said he hammered the last 20, and I was looking at it on Strava and he did. He didn't catch anyone, and he wasn't saying that because he was upset. He was just like, it was incredible how hard I was running and how hard Scott was running in front of me, and we didn't catch anyone. Like, there was a lot of no man's and no woman's running just the whole time, because people were holding their pace and just not really slowing down that much. I mean that definitely, you had written a spot of like, does running conservatively and picking off people in back, does that still work? I'm going to say
it still works.
Yes,
how come?
Still. Because Because at the end of the day, if you have a goal of running 18 hours and 30 minutes and someone runs 18:31 going out really, really hard, 18:30 is always going to beat 18:31. Doesn't matter how you do it. I think the hardest part of running these smart races is how well you can calculate it, which, you know, like Leah and Tyler, they are very good at calculating where they need to be for them at various parts on the course. And I think that is a very special superpower that maybe can be taught, but I feel like this something in it's like it takes a certain type of runner to have that kind of faith and trust in themselves to be able to write these splits and be like, if I hit these, I'll hit this time. Historically, if I hit this time, I will be here.
Well, there's an interest. So I don't know. Have you had a chance to read David Roche's most recent Western States article?
The seven quick hitters.
So
things. I'm at number four.
What's interesting, right, he mentioned something interesting in that article. It's very much like inflation where people just get priced out even if they're doing all the right things. 1830 in 2022 doesn't get you what it used to get you. So, for example, you know, Leah ran 1830 this year. That time would have gotten her second place in 2009. It would have won the race for her in 2013. In 2016, it would have been second. This year, all it got her was sixth place, you know, you know, 90 minutes behind the leader. And obviously, first of all, Lee is amazing, amazing race. But it, we're just using her race as an example for, like, should you run a patient conservative race or should you go from the start?
Yeah.
It's totally interesting.
But what if she knows that on her best day she runs 18:30, not 18 flat, and you go and try run 18 flat, and now that turns into 20
That's
hours?
That's a great point, but... And maybe Leah, because
that's usually
maybe
how that
Leah
works.
Does know what her limits are. But then I think for me the question becomes: how do you explore your limits at the top end of the sport? Because I feel like
I think it's definitely different from person to person. But like in Leah's case, I believe her. I bet she ran about as fast as she could have run on that day, and like nailed it to perfection. Now, the counter argument is, does that mean some other people in the field could have gone much faster if they were able to bring that pacing and that mindset the way she did? I don't know if that's not maybe not really an answerable question, but like, I think running a smart race is still smart. Because, you know, if Tyler runs a smart race for 15 flat, he wins. Did Tyler think he was in 15 flat shape? Like, maybe not. Maybe Tyler's like, I'm on my greatest day, I'm going to run 16 hours or just a hair under, because that's still going to be, you know, 45 minutes faster than I've ever run on the course.
I guess my question is,
you know, then that just, I think that just, it, that's just how competitive it is now.
I guess my question there is, do you necessarily have to run a series of conservative but progressively better races to reach your potential? Or can you short circuit that and just get to your potential by taking a risk right off the bat? Like, I think Tyler Green just PR'd at Western States this year. He just ran whatever it was, 15:55. And I think that was the fastest. Yeah, it was the fastest
45
he's ever
minutes
had.
Faster.
Could he have run that 4 years ago?
I don't think so. I mean, I think he's four years more trained too. You know, I think he's in better shape than he was 4 years ago. Not only does he have a bunch of hundreds under his belt, he also is better. Now, take Tyler's fitness right now and put it into his lack of experience 4 years ago. Does he run under 16 hours at Western States? I don't think he does, because I think he's learned a whole bunch of things in the series of events that he's come across leading up to this point now. And is that the route that every single person's going to take? No. I think some, like, I mean, Adam Peterman, he just won the race in his debut 100. But at the same time, what if he's going to look back on this 4 years ago and be like, man, I sucked. That was so bad.
Yeah.
that could be the case. As great as everyone's saying it is right now, which it is, he might be thinking, I don't know. I think I executed Chuckanut better. Maybe that's the case too. Like, it's amazing how deep all the fields are. Like there were some races this year.
It was
just with how the times are so close together.
Like anytime I see Tyler Green and Drew Holman in the same race, they're always neck and neck. They're always pushing each other, and you can always count on a thrilling finish. I think they did this. I mean, pretty much last year at Western States, right? Or they were within range of each other towards the end. I think they've done this at a couple like local 50-mile Oregon races. Like, they're quite a competitive duo from the same team too.
Yeah, it's interesting, and yet Drew lives over in Colorado. Like, you'd think they were training partners too, but that's just like maybe Nike just seeks after a certain
type. By the way, I feel so bad. I picked against him for this race, and because I think my biggest concern was that it would just be really difficult to expect him to mentally replicate the gauntlet that he went through in 2021 to finish third. And there he was at the finish line this year, throwing up. Like, the guy is so freaking tough, in addition to being a great athlete. And
he's very tough.
I mean, just, you know, I'm not wearing a hat, but figurative hats off to this guy. Just incredible. Such an inspiring athlete.
Yeah, I'm just in awe at how tough the top 10, like, men and women had to be in order to be in the top 10 this year. Like, they had to dig so deep from pretty early on. I mean, I did a pretty deep dive across most of the splits in the second half, just on Strava as I could see them. And they were very close. Like, the difference between, you know, F1 to F10's split from Forest Hill to the river, they were like not that far apart. You know, the range for them was very close, which means at any given point on the race, you are not allowed to fall asleep. Like, you cannot mentally take your mind off the gas pedal. And it's just, it's so amazing how you can just stay that mentally engaged for, you know, 15 to 20 hours. I would love to figure that part out. I got some fun. I got a fun stat. So, I guess it's so going back to my deep dive this morning while I was eating my oatmeal of some impressive Strava splits. You know, I went through probably 30 or 40 different segments on the Western States course just to see if anything super interesting popped up. And I think my favorite one is the unofficial Kyle Pietari Award of top of Roby Drive to the track. It's actually a hidden segment, so on the Strava mobile app you can't see it. You have to go on the computer and go all the way to the bottom and hit hidden segments. But do you know who closed, at least according to Strava, the fastest this year?
Male or female?
Male.
I'm gonna guess on the female side it was Leah. And on the male side, I'm gonna guess Drew Holman.
All right, so you're wrong on both sides. On the ladies' side, it was Luzia Buehler. She went from the top of Roby Drive to the track in 10 minutes and 13 seconds, which I think is about, it's like 7 and change or 8-minute pace, which you still have to crest the hill. And then there's that whole flat, slightly up section as well before making your way past the white bridge and then onto the track. But on the guys' side, it was Mr. Chris Thoburn who finished in 28 hours and 2 seconds. He freaking hammered all the way from the paved section of Roby Point, like all the way up the paved climb, and just hauled ass to the finish. He did it in 8 minutes and 10 seconds, which is 6:53 pace.
And you got to wonder what the G8, what the grade adjusted pace is on that too with all the hills there.
Yeah, it's amazing. And like, I looked at it on Strava, and then I looked at his ultra live split, and like, it all checks out. Like, The dude was on a tear the last 1.3 miles. And I just loved getting to
We don't do this very often, but I think we have to make a request of the audience. If you could go and find this guy on Strava, we'll link to him in the show notes. Please go and comment on his Western States and particularly emphasize his hauling of ass that last mile to close out Western States, because
yeah if you go to Ultra Live and you see his Roby point to the finish, his section pace is 7:02.
That's awesome.
I loved finding that.
And all right, so we got that Rod Farvard podcast about manipulating your brain to think you're cooler than you are. We'll link to that, and we'll link to this guy Strava too to give him some kudos and comments. Okay, we should probably get to this too, great, before we move on. The debate about whether conventional wisdom of sauna training and heat exposure during training is better than this sort of new guard strategy of wearing all these cooling systems and just like, you know, better overall training theory applications for races like Western States. Where do you stand on this?
Yeah. You know, I think there's room for both. You know, like, I don't think the heat training aspect of training for Western States really takes up that much time, because, you know, like, the current science behind the body being heat adapted, you know, and like listening to the latest Trail Society podcast with Corinne and Hillary and Keely. Corinne did a big deep dive about kind of the sauna and like the current like sauna protocol to get physiologically fully heat adapted is roughly, you know, five to six sauna sessions over the course of a 7-day period, ideally all consecutively in a row. 20 minutes in a pretty hot sauna, you know, like we're looking at 170 degrees Fahrenheit. But not any longer than that. And that's long enough to stimulate, you know, all the right parts of the body to increase that blood volume and essentially get really good at sweating and teaching the body how to, you know, dissipate that heat. You know, I definitely think there's still an element of like mentally being comfortable at running in the heat that is beneficial to train for as well, because you still feel the warmth out there. But I feel like if you're doing all the cooling stuff, like, I guess maybe one day we'll have someone who does no heat training at all and then just does all the cooling stuff. But I feel like right now it's easy enough to check both those boxes, and I wouldn't want to leave any stone unturned getting ready for the race. You know, I think where people are getting better at is the cooling part. I feel like the heat training part, people are pretty dialed in on. But now with the during the race cooling, we're going to see big, big jumps in that. And yeah, that's an interesting thing to practice, because there's not a lot of, for some people, there's not that many days where you can just go out and run and totally ice yourself down and practice going through this huge cooling.
I was
going
to say, should you train with that? Should you train with those cooling systems prior to the race?
I mean, it would sure help to make sure that like the Nike ice vest doesn't chafe your armpits or something like that. Or, you know, you have this pack and you're like, oh, I'm gonna throw all this ice in it, and then you run one step and it all bounces out and you're like, well, damn, I should have tested that first. You know, there's those sorts of things where you just want to, yeah, you just need to be more dialed. But I think the sauna and the heat exposure training, I think that's still important. Is it more important than cooling yourself really well during the race? I don't know, because I did both. I did a lot of sauna work and I did a really good job of keeping myself cool during the race, and I didn't feel too hot ever. You know, I never needed to like sit down and be like, I need to take time to cool off. So yeah, I think for me, like, the debate's still open on that one.
Couple more questions I think we should entertain about the top 10. Two. Who do you think doesn't come back next year on the men's and the women's side from the top 10? And then who do you think just missed it this year that's going to try to race their way back in?
So on the ladies' side, I don't know if Ruth comes back next year. She didn't want to come back after last year, but she really wanted to win. You know, Ruth's a winner. She's won 11 of her last 12 races, with the non-win being last year at Western States. She won Western States, so I could see it totally as a time to potentially move on. You know, Western States, it's a really hard course record to chase because you have no idea what you're going to get until like a week out from the race. So like, you have to really love this race to just like keep doing it year after year, hoping that you get a cold year to try and crack the course record on. And there's a lot of other cool races to do. So I don't know if Ruth comes back.
I think a lot of that women's top 10, or at least 40% of it, has question marks for me. Like, I could see that whole European contingent. So like Camille, Luzia not coming back. I could see Ailsa McDonald not coming back as well. I want to say she had expressed doubts coming back this time around. It was just like she wanted to quote unquote like get the race right. And I think when you run sub 18 hours on this course, that's pretty feel good. And then on the men's side, like, I think again, those two Euros, Ludovic and Vincent, you know, do they come back? I don't know. But I actually see the rest of the top 10 holding firm and coming back, like the Cody Lynn, Scott Trey is already confirmed on Instagram, I think, from what I saw. You know, the only other question marks I might have are like, does Alex Nichols want to come back? What about Tyler Green?
I know he has Alex has unfinished business at UTMB. So maybe he chooses to, you know, put the effort on that. I heard Tyler Green might not come back, you know, just cause you know, he's about to be a dad pretty soon. And, you know, he wants to, you know, not only be there for Rachel and his kid, but also in the future, you know, year, couple years, you know, really give Rachel the opportunity to, you know, run as much as she wants and, you know, get back in shape and accomplish, you know, her future running goals that she still has. So, I don't expect to see Tyler back next year for reasons I totally understand.
Okay, so there could be movement on both sides. Who do you see desiring to race their way back in next year that like just missed the top 10?
Let's see. I think Jeff Colt has got to try it again. I mean, that dude had a phenomenal race. Like literally having COVID like 10 days ago and testing negative 2 days before the race and still not feeling great and having like no idea what was going to happen and still getting 11th, breaking 17 hours.
Yep.
That's pretty incredible. I think he has lots of room to improve on this course, even if he just goes into it in the exact same fitness, but doesn't have the same lead up that he did. I would love to see Cole Watson.
Do you think he will
take another crack at Western States? I hope so. You know, I think there's still some things that he wants to figure out. Like his stomach, you know, turned on him pretty bad the last 20 miles and he was kind of puking a little bit and the wheels kind of fell off. So there's still some things to iron out. You know, it might still, you know, he put forth a pretty monumental effort. So it might take a little while to get him to come back to terms with wanting to do this race again. But I hope he does because, you know, he's a really good runner. I want to see Reed Coolset take a crack at States again now that he's been an ultra runner for almost a year.
Well, I heard him say on Instagram that he doesn't see himself returning to the 100-mile distance anytime soon. He's going to focus on that 50K to 80K distance, and I think JFK and Comrades are high on his list.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, do that while he's still got some speed left in the old hammer sticks.
On the women's side, Anne-Marie Madden makes sense to come back. She had a great race. She just missed the top 10. She was 4 minutes off the top 10.
Same with Aroa, yeah. Sio, who got 12th. I had kind of, we'd gone back and forth a little bit throughout the day, and our crews were together pretty much the whole time. And she was so dialed, so steady, really all the way until, you know, just the final few miles when the wheels kind of fell off. But my crew was telling me that when she got the golden ticket at Canyons, she thought that golden ticket was for 2023 Western States. And then accepted it and was like, you're running Western States in 8 weeks. And was like, oh, okay, we're running Western States in 8 weeks. And then just flipped the switch and was like, okay, we're doing it a year early. I think, you know, that this was her first one. So there's room, you know, room for improvement there as well. You know, just the like attitude and approach that she took on the day was awesome. Sounds like, I think I would like to see Ellie Pell take a crack at Western States again. You know, it sounded like she ran a really, really hard race. Perhaps hard at some spots that shouldn't have been. And, you know, that caused the slippage of a couple spots, but I bet she learned a lot. And it, you know, all I heard were, you know, from, you know, my crew and other people was just comments of like how tough she was and how much she was able to eat at aid stations and how impressive that was. Like my crew is like, oh, it was amazing. She was sitting there at Pointed Rocks at mile 95 and had just like five quesadillas and three PB&Js and like handful of strawberries and potato chips, and then just like bolted on out of there. And prior to that, they were like, oh, I don't know, she doesn't look great. But then just like was able to rally so well and hold it on like strong at the end after going out pretty hot. So, I mean, when you can just have that kind of toughness and ability to do those sorts of things, when, you know, the pacing and all the other little parts get put in the right order, I think she has a really, really strong performance in her future.
And there may be, agree on Ellie Pell. Also, seems like she's like a really, truly a student of the sport too. So excited to see what she lines up for next year if she decides to do the whole golden ticket route again. I think another thing to bring up is there are some blessings in the sport. There's the sponsor spot route, and you know, there's strings that people can pull. Like, I mean, Courtney DeWalter, you know, had the DNF Hard Rock last year, but she's back in, and I think as fans of the sport, we don't really care how she got in. We're just stoked to see her race it and hopefully go for the course record. And I think the same can be said about Western States. Like, hopefully, no matter what, people like Brittany Peterson and Tim Tollefson, just, you know, we find a way to get them back in the race, because it's just more fun to follow the race at the top end when they're there. And people like Tim and Brittany both have chances to win. So I have no problem with just getting them in anyway.
So this just popped in my head that I'm just going to start the conspiracy now. So I got into the race via the mile 90 aid station spot, because every aid station on the course gets one entry that they're able to divvy out however they like. And that's the Rogue Valley Runner sponsored spot. You know who worked the aid station at mile 90 this year?
No way.
Scott Jurek. So if he runs a qualifier, I'm just going to throw it out there. He worked the aid station. It could happen.
We buried that 72 minutes into the episode. That's the hottest take of this episode.
I didn't think of it until just now. But I mean, it was really cool to see Scott and Hal, you know, fill in my bottles coming through the mile 98 station, just, you know, to have nine total Western States wins for a couple aid station volunteers. But yeah, if Scott knocks out a qualifier, he could potentially be lining up for States next year.
That's the best news. All right, last topic I want to I think we should cover here. I think there's a lot of runners, when they don't have a great day at Western States, they immediately think to what else can they do the rest of the year to log a good result. I think there's a lot of people in the Western field, for example, that either had the DNF or walk it in, that are thinking UTMB. And I think my question to you is, should athletes that have bad races at Western logically pivot to the UTMB 100, or is the damage equal whether or not they had a bad race and it's still a UTMB double no matter what, and they should rethink that idea?
I guess I think it comes down to a couple of things. Like, why did they have a bad race? Like, if they got injured, you know, there's not, I don't think it makes sense to try and pivot for anything. You gotta let yourself heal, and then just, it is what it is. You know, if you had a bad race and then you preemptively pulled the plug thinking, I can pivot to UTMB, did you already lose the race, Western States, before it happened because you already had this out in your head? Some people, I think, can definitely pivot to a later race, but I think with how competitive Western States is, you shouldn't really be thinking much beyond the finish line of the race on that day. And like, you should be doing everything you can to have your best Western States, because that's why you're there. You can't already be thinking, oh, if I have a bad day here, I'll just go run UTMB. I mean, if you have a bad day at UTMB, then I'll just go run something else. But like, there should be no pivots until after the whole thing's over. Now you can start thinking about it. Because I think that's just the mindset that has to be taken into this race now.
One totally irrelevant thing that just came to mind, and I got to say it because it makes me so happy to say it. Adam Peterman, who is, I think, my favorite person in the sport now. I love that guy. Like, you could not pick a nicer person to be the best runner in our sport, or at least one of them. But remember when people were giving him so much shit, or like two people were giving him so much shit for sitting on the golden ticket decision and taking his time to assess whether or not he was recovered enough post Canyons to put the work in to be successful at Western? Well, he did it.
Like, oh no, someone cares about their future races so much that they spend time to think about whether it's a good idea that they can run to their standard. Like, Adam was thinking in his head, can I run Western States this year to the standard that I, Adam Peterman, think I can run it? I'm so glad that he decided, yes, I can run it to my standard, because not only did he do it, he made for a really, really exciting day. And also, he is such a nice... So I got to meet him after the race, because he was sitting next to Cole and we were talking about our races, and you know, I congratulated Adam, and like, the very first thing he says is, oh, you've got a wristband on, how did you do? Like, he just wanted to hear about my race. And you know, after we finished talking, we were in the golden hour, the last few runners were coming in, we're on the rail, you know, 50 meters from the finish, and he is just like bent a foot over the rail, just screaming at everyone coming in, because he was just so hyped about people getting in before the 30-hour mark. And I was like, this is the Western States champ right here. Like, how cool. Like, yeah, I was like, good vibes all around.
Thank you, Adam Peterman, for thinking through your decision, not making an emotional decision, checking yourself, then putting in a great training block, and just, yeah.
How long do you have to decide before?
You have 2 weeks.
Well, to
2 weeks, yeah. And I think he just accept your totally spot reasonable. For next like, year. You never know. I mean, you can have like those like fake "I feel great" moments.
No, like for states 2023.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because he won. Does he get all the way like forever? Like, is he already just automatically in?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, I think he said. Yeah. Let me pull up his Instagram. I think he said something. Adam Speederman. Adam Speederman. We got a Roomba, you know, to like clean up all the dust around the house, and it's pretty efficient. So we actually nicknamed it Speederman. I think he's coming back. I think he said. Actually, I don't want to speak for him. I have no idea. I thought I saw something, but maybe I didn't. Anyways, love that guy.
Yeah.
Two non-Western States topics first of all, Zach Miller's back.
Yeah, he ran the Angora 100, which I at first thought was 100 mile, and then he ran like 14 hours, and I was like, whoa, that's so fast. But then I was like, I don't know, a lot of the pictures look very difficult. Turns out it's just a very, very, very difficult 100K, like 23,000 feet of climbing. So it was cool. So yeah, Zach won in his, maybe it was a Strava post. He said the goal was to come in and win this,
which he did,
to secure my spot for UTMB. Yes. So as far as that goes, we will see Zach Miller towing the line at UTMB this year.
It's been 3 years.
Very exciting. I saw a finish of him. Huh? Yeah. And it's exciting to see. I saw a video of Zach's finish. It looked like a classic Zach finish where it looked like he was finishing a mile. I looked at his Strava, and his last 5 miles were all just barely over 7 minute pace. And he finished and immediately collapsed to the ground, completely gassed. And I loved it. Like, classic Zach Miller seems to be back. And I hope that, you know, he's just healthy and enjoying doing what he does, because
he is.
Zach Miller is good for the sport. Like, I think he just can remind people of how tough you can be. And he's one of the few that, like, really pushes the limits of the human body. And reminds people, like, okay, if he can do that, I can do that. But sometimes it takes seeing someone to do it for you to do it yourself. So I'm really happy that Zach's healthy and back racing, and, you know, wish him all the best in his recovery and his training and lead up for UTMB, because anytime healthy Zach starts a race, regardless of how it happens, he makes it very exciting for a long time, sometimes the entire time.
Last thing here, I thought this was cool, at least it popped up on my social media about a week ago. There's these two guys, I think one the audience will recognize, Michael McKnight, who's very well known on the 200 mile scene, is facing off against his friend Ben Light, who I don't think people will know. But what's interesting is they're both racing each other on the Arizona Trail to see who can finish the entirety of it first. They're starting, one is starting on the north end, one is starting on the south end, and they're racing each other. And I think there's going to be crews for each of them. There's going to be video cameras. There's going to be brands behind it. And I don't think we've seen a race like this on a long distance trail that's been, like, formally organized before. I could be wrong, but this is the first time I've seen the likes of this, and it's going to happen in October. And I'm very excited to see how people receive this, because if the live coverage at Western States and Broken Arrow is any indication, I think this will be well received, well watched. And I'm also curious, because Michael McKnight's like this famous 200 mile kind of elite guy at the top of the sport, and I don't think anybody really knows Ben Light, so I'm curious why that matchup came to be. But I also think anytime you're racing for 13, 14 days, a lot can happen, and there's a lot of equalization that happens. So I don't know. I thought that was cool. I thought we'd bring that up.
How do you get to decide who goes which way? One way has to be faster than the other. Like, do they just put
the
coin?
But we'll link to this in the show notes as well. It might only be on Instagram, so I might just link Michael's profile, but I thought that was super cool. And then for us, this is just for you and me, but like you, me, I think we're going to have Leah Yingling. Actually, that's another piece of news. We'll have Leah come on to, because Brett can't take all the expertise since I've been failing us on a lot of these predictions. Leah's going to come on to provide another expert voice. Leah's going to do the UTMB and Speed Goat previews with us. And what's cool is Travis Longcar, who's built the whole fantasy free trail platform. They've added a feature where there's like a drop down for each athlete, and you can easily pull up their Strava profiles and their ultra sign up data. Dude, that's going to be so much easier for us to just analyze athletes.
And yeah, as well as their Instagram, their social media is also, you can also click on that. So yeah, from the free trail site, you can do a very deep exploration of who your picks are, which clearly Finn and I need a lot of help on, because I messaged Leah and I was like, hey, did you do the Western States free trail picks? How'd you do? And she was like, Oh man, it was embarrassing. I think she was like, I got 120th. Clearly some work to do on the, and I was like, oh, well, Finn got 585th and I got 535th out of 1,070. So I was smack dab right in the middle, but yeah, she was embarrassed at her 100th place.
Oh my
and
gosh.
I was like, oh, you beat us by 400 spots. So yeah, please come in and just take our jobs for these previews. So I'm really excited to have Leah to come on and break down Speed Goat and UTMB with us, because she won Free Trail Fantasy for Broken Arrow.
It was super funny.
We were outside
of this conversation, I'm like, we're pretty good friends, and good friends with her husband Mike as well, and we were camping in the Tushers Mountains together last weekend, and we're just sitting by the fire, and I like walked up to her, I'm like, hey, Leah, do you want to like join our next preview episode? And she was like, yeah, because she just loves this stuff. But it was just funny because I'm just like, you're a legend, you know so much about the
awesome.
sport, like we would be so grateful if like you just join our conversation. But anyways, so we got that. Yeah. That's good news. Anyways, I don't know, I feel like we covered a lot of good stuff here with Western States. Slightly unique long run archives episode in that we focused mostly on Western States, but I'm happy with it.
Yeah. One little tidbit from Europe. Jim Walmsley training update from Europe. Last week, he ran for 113 miles and climbed 43,574 feet. That's 13,200 meters. The mountain legs are coming. They're coming in strong over in Europe. Jim's adopting the Euro lifestyle just fine. And yeah, he's climbing a lot. I just wanted to say
that's
that.
That's wild.
Monitoring.
Yeah, I mean, that harkens back to like the work he did in Silverton. What was it? 2018 year, where he's doing like 50K.
Yeah. But that was like intense. That was like intense.
Yeah.
You know, shred
that's
monk.
Right. That's right.
I think that might be a Debo coined term. Like shred monk stats where like he's just all in, hyper focused on everything. Over the, he ran with someone almost every single one of those runs. Like he's just appears to be going out and enjoying it much more, just like having more purpose than just I am doing this run so I can win this race. Like you said, one of his goals was like adopt the culture, learn, like not just go for the mountains, go for the people, go for the fun times. I think he's doing a good job of that, and I'm really excited to see what a UTMB focused Jim Walmsley does.
Super cool. Well, we'll be monitoring closely. I'm sure we'll have another one at the end of the month. And yeah. Well, Brett, this has been fun. I think the next time we're back is for Speed Goat in a couple weeks. But what are you doing? For recovery? You doing anything cool in July, running wise?
No, I've got nothing. I've got nothing planned right now. I'm gonna ride bikes. I'm excited to become a cyclist. I've been an indoor cyclist for the last 6 months, you know, as some cross training, just because it was winter and I'm a fair weather cyclist. But now that the weather's good and I don't have any races on the schedule, I can go do some adventures and not worry as much if I crash. So
cool.
Yeah, I'm gonna go ride some bikes. Could try and get a Strava crown on the bike. That's been like one of my lifelong goals. There's a lot of really good bikers here in Ashland, and I can't get them up or down. So I've got to be able to find one that I can get.
That's a wrap. Until next time. See ya.